LegalizeFreedom.com. Why are we here? Where do we come from? Where are we going? From the nature of reality to the future of humanity. Beyond politics, poverty, and war. LegalizeFreedom.com.
I imagine that right now you're feeling a bit like Alice, tumbling down the rabbit hole. I can see it in your eyes. You have the look of a man who accepts what he sees because he is expecting to wake up. Let me tell you why you're here. You're here because you know something. What you know you can't explain, but you feel it. You felt it your entire life. That there's something wrong with the world. You don't know what it is, but it's there, like a splinter in your mind, driving you mad. Do you know what I'm talking about? Do you want to know what it is?
Right now, we're inside a computer program.
Is it really so hard to believe? Your appearance now is what we call residual self-image. It is the mental projection of your digital self.
This isn't real.
What is real? How do you define real? If you're talking about what you can feel, what you can smell, what you can taste and see, then real is simply electrical signals interpreted by your brain. What is real? How do you define real? 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 What is real? How do you define
real? Greetings and welcome once again to LegalizeFreedom.com for this, the 150th edition. I'm your host, Greg Moffat, and I want to start today by doing something that I'm not very good at, asking for money. In the past, I've tacked a mention of donations onto the end of the show, but listeners have increasingly been telling me that I should literally be more upfront about this. Creating these programs is, of course, about exploring ideas and sharing them, never about money. But there are costs involved, not least in terms of time. At the time of this recording in July 2015, I have around 80,000 listeners each month who stream or download at least one show. As you can imagine, it would change my life if even a modest percentage of you donated even a few pence. As things stand, I average around £10 a month, which currently converts to about €14 or $15 US. If you'd like to donate something, you can do so simply by visiting the Legalize Freedom website and clicking on the donate button. You can do this as a one-off or as a regular recurring payment. If you don't wish to use PayPal, drop me a line and maybe we can sort something else out. You'll find contact details on the About page of the website. Every penny helps, and I really appreciate your support. Okay, on with the show. My guest today is Tom Campbell, who joins us for the first in a series of conversations about his book, My Big Toe, which is actually three books in one: Awakening, Discovery, and Inner Workings. The trilogy is about life, purpose, personal significance, physics, evolution, and the reason why. The acronym TOE is a standard term in the physics community that stands for Theory of Everything, and such a theory has been the holy grail of physicists for more than 50 years. My Big TOE delivers a solution to that scientific quest at the layman's level with precision and clarity. It unifies science and philosophy, physics and metaphysics, mind and matter, purpose and meaning, the normal and the paranormal. The entirety of human experience, mind, body and spirit, including both our objective and subjective worlds, are brought together under one seamless scientific understanding. If you have a logical, open and inquisitive mind, an attitude of scientific pragmatism that appreciates the elegance of fundamental truth and the thrill of breakthrough, you'll enjoy this journey of personal and scientific discovery. Based upon careful scientific research and logical deduction, it's a book for all who have an interest in the nature of the reality in which they exist. It's not only about scientific theory, function, process, and discovery, but also speaks to each individual reader about their innate capabilities. Readers will learn to appreciate that their human potential stretches far beyond the limitations of the physical universe. The trilogy delivers the next major scientific conceptual breakthrough since relativity and quantum mechanics raised scientific eyebrows in the first half of the 20th century. No catch, no megalomania, no hypothetical wackiness, no goofy beliefs, no unusual assumptions, just straightforward science that better describes the totality of our experience and provides a wealth of practical results and new understanding that can be applied personally and professionally by scientists and non-scientists alike. It's the real thing. Hello and welcome, Tom, and thank you so much for joining us today on LegalizeFreedom.com.
Well, thank you, Greg. I'm glad to be here.
Tom, today we're going to talk a little bit about some of the concepts and ideas in your trilogy of books, Awakening, Discovery, Inner Workings, taken together, My Big Toe, Toe standing for Theory of Everything. It sounds big, it is big. Before we dive into that, tell listeners just a little bit about your background and your work in general. I mean, I give this opening question to all the guests, but your background's a little bit more interesting than most, shall we say.
I don't know about that, but anyway, I'm a physicist, and I've had two careers, really, in my life, and they've both run parallel with each other. I got out of graduate school in about early 1970s, and I started my first job in physics. I'm not an academic physicist. I'm an applied physicist. That's one that works in the real world. And about, a few months after I started my first employment, I also met Bob Monroe and started working with him to study altered states of consciousness. So both of my careers, like I say, launched in and around the same time, give or take a few months. And now that was early 70s, so we're talking now 40 years ago, 40 plus. And I spent maybe 20 hours a week with Bob Monroe, and of course 40 hours a week and plus, more like 45 most of the time, with my day job. So my day job and my night job. So it was really gave me a broader scope of reality and of nature and what's going on, because as physicists, what we do is model reality. That's what physics is. We make models, often mostly mathematical models, of reality. We try to figure, how does reality work? What's the logic of reality? What's the causal chain? And my work with Bob was to understand consciousness. And of course, I approached it as a physicist would. What is consciousness? How does it work? You know, what's the causal chain? What can you do? What can't you do? What are the limits? You know, where's the repeatability? What variables are important and which are not, and so on. So I approached both as a scientist. And after probably 5-6 years of 20 hours a week with Bob Monroe, then I kind of slipped out the back of that for a while and became a member of the board of directors of what was then TMI, which is the Monroe Institute. But most of my work with Bob was before there was a TMI, before they were situated in the land and where they are the present day. It was kind of the old days when things were not very well structured. It was just Bob and myself and Dennis and a few other people, Nancy Lee, who came later. We were just studying consciousness, and we were our own, guinea pigs. We were the lab rats too. So we studied it. We did experiments, and we did them on ourselves, because you have to get to know yourself. Your own consciousness is really where you start before you start thinking of something bigger than that. So I've had these two careers, and after about 35 years of studying consciousness, I felt I had a handle on how it all worked, what was going on. And that had to do, that was the culmination, I should say, of about 35 years of research in consciousness. And most of that was done within the larger consciousness system, within the larger reality. That is, it wasn't all research in the physical reality where you're looking at somebody else's consciousness. These were experiential explorations that were going on. But of course, like science requires, they had to be repeatable. You had to know what was happening and how and why, and do your experiments over and over again, changing one variable at a time and so on before you kind of understood what was going on. So then I wrote these books. It took me about 5 years to write these books. I published them in 2003. So they've been out for a little over a decade. They are the kind of the results and conclusions of my, of 35 years of trying to figure out how the larger reality worked. And an interesting thing is I started just trying to explain consciousness, altered states and consciousness and how consciousness, and this physical world interacted. What were the connections? What was consciousness and what could you do with your consciousness? And were any of these paranormal things real or were they all just, you know, hallucinations and that sort of thing? And I started writing my book to explain all of that. And then when I got done, I realized probably a year or two after they were published that the very same ideas, concepts, and logic that I used to explain consciousness also explained physics. And it was sort of like, oh my God, look at that. The same ideas here explain quantum mechanics. And the big question in quantum mechanics, of course, is, why is quantum mechanics so weird? Why is it that particles are best represented, best modeled by probability distributions? And we know that if you make that assumption that they're not particles, they're probability distributions, then you can calculate right answers. If you don't make that assumption, if you say, oh no, they're particles, then you can't get any right answers. So we know that that's the way it is, but we don't know why. And my theory just explained why. The same logic that explained consciousness and the larger consciousness system also explained quantum mechanics. And then I looked a little harder and it also explained relativity. And the big mystery in relativity is, why is the speed of light a constant? You see, the speed of light is a constant it's always a constant no matter how fast or how much velocity the source has. The light that comes from that source always goes the same speed. And in science, we just give that the letter C. So C is the speed of light, and it's always constant. And nothing else in our reality works that way. Everything else, velocities are additive. In other words, if you're driving in a car at 10 mile an hour and you put your arm out the window with a baseball and then you throw the baseball 10 mile an hour in the direction the car is going, the actual baseball is going 20 miles an hour relative to the ground, because you get 10 miles an hour from your throw and 10 miles an hour from the car, and they add together. And everything in our reality works that way except light. With light, it's always the speed of light no matter how fast or what direction your source is moving. So that's another big mystery. But if we assume, as Einstein did, that that's the case, that light travels at a constant speed, then special relativity falls right out of that assumption. That's the assumption that drives special relativity. And then, of course, general relativity is a generalization of special relativity. So two big mysteries of physics that have been mysteries, all along. There's never been anybody who really has a clue why they're like that. They're solved. So I could see that, of course, C is a constant. That's necessary. That's a logical necessity in my theory. And of course, particles are probability distributions. That's a logical necessity in my theory. So then I started looking at other things and realized that I had a complete blueprint for modern science with the same logic that I had developed to explain consciousness. And of course, that made me feel good, because if you have a toe, you really need to explain everything. And indeed, it turned out that if you understand consciousness, you can understand everything else. That it makes one overarching understandings or ideas or concepts that explain, you know, physics as well as metaphysics, the normal and paranormal. Matter of fact, paranormal just becomes normal. It's just a larger viewpoint in which all of what we now call para, which means kind of beyond normal, is just normal. Now, things like objectivity versus subjectivity, it works with both of those. So it explains your subjective experiences as well as your objective experiences, whereas physics just talks about objective experience. So it is truly a theory of everything in that all the, all the things that a person can experience, from relativistic things to quantum mechanical things to personal things, all have some fundamental explanation in this theory. So that was more than I intended to do and more than I had bargained for, but it worked out so nicely that it gives me confidence that it's right. Now, when I say it gives me confidence, you know, I wouldn't want anybody to believe this theory, and I'm not trying to encourage anyone to believe it. Belief is the problem. We want to not believe things. But a model, this is a model, and I call it a theory. A theory and a model are basically synonymous with each other. It's a model of reality. And models aren't judged to be good because they're, you know, because you believe in them. They're not judged to be good because they're perfect either. They're judged to be good if they answer all the data. If everything that is known can be explained with fewer assumptions and in a more elegant way, then the model is a good model. And furthermore, if it can predict new things that we don't understand and we don't know, and then experiment can verify those things, then it's a really good model. So that's how physics determines whether models are good or not. It's not whether they match current beliefs, but it's do they produce? Do they demonstrate the facts in a more elegant and with fewer assumptions than anything else? And mine does that. It predicts new things and it explains the old things. So again, more than I thought I was going to accomplish, but it turned out very well. And my viewpoint is that it's the best model we have at the present time. But models are living things. You know, they'll change. As new data comes in, we'll find things that aren't covered or things that we hadn't thought about. And then the model either will cover those and answer them nicely, or it won't. And if it won't, that means the model is incomplete or perhaps even just wrong. So a model has to evolve and grow as the input data comes in. You know, a long time ago, back in Newton's day, we called things laws. You know, we have Newton's laws. Well, that turned out to be a lot of hubris that, we knew exactly what we were doing and we knew almost everything. And now physicists realize that, you know, we don't talk about the law of relativity or the law of quantum mechanics because we realize that that's foolishness. All the information isn't in yet. So it's the theory of relativity and the theory of quantum mechanics. It's evolutionary theory. Everything in science today is theory or, equivalently, models, because we know that new information could come in the future and the models would have to change, modify, grow, or be replaced. So that's kind of where I am. And my background is, like I say, I'm a physicist. I did work. I'm retired now. But I did work my entire career in both physics and consciousness research. And these books and my videos, I have about 120 videos on YouTube, are the culmination of all of that work.
There's so many points come up there for me, but let's just try and address a few of them. As far as laws and constants go, so many of these, really in the light of your work, are kind of revealed as more likely to be local and limited. But of course, because of our narrow viewpoint, to say our, not necessarily yours or mine, but as generally his species, we kind of assume this has to apply everywhere, you know, despite some evidence even that some of these laws and constants break down when you get great distances away from the Earth, for example. And as far as supernormal and paranormal or supernatural and all these other terms that get bandied about, you mentioned in one of the books that from our perspective, it's a bit like being, you know, staying in the house all the time and going from room to room and thinking, oh, you know, reality. And then once you've been around the whole house, you think you understand it and you haven't actually gone outside ever. Limited perspective, I think, is incredibly important here. But we, you know, as a species, I think we've always had a tendency to go there. If you look down the ages, it's always like kind of, now we understand what's going on. Now we've arrived. And the people who came before us didn't really know what was going on. We do. And from here, it's, you know.
Yeah, it's always like that. You know, you can look back in history, particularly in science, and you will find back in the 1800s, scientists bemoaning the fact that all the inventions and everything, you know, that science will ever know has already been discovered. There's nothing left to do. We know it all now. And then they'd say, well, okay, maybe we don't know it all, but we know almost everything that's important. And you'll hear the lament of there's nothing else to be discovered. It's all been done. Of course, that's back in the 1800s, and we know there's been a huge amount of scientific discovery has taken place past that point. But today, you hear a lot of the same things. You know, well, almost everything that's knowable is we know, and there's very little yet to be discovered. All we have to do now is pick out the details so that we understand the details better. And indeed, that's what most scientists do. That's what their careers are. They pick at the logic of the details. And that's what they write their papers about. But that's not true either. You know, every generation or every person really feels that they know almost everything important. Oh, I've been around the block a few times. I know how the world works and I know, you know, the score and the way things are. And we say that sort of thing because you don't know what you don't know. Now, that's pretty obvious, but you are completely ignorant of your ignorance. You see, what you don't know is invisible to you. What you do know seems like it's massive and long, and it's been the accumulation of knowledge for 2,000 years. And, you know, what else could be added to it? So you try to look at what else could be added to it, and, of course, you're ignorant there because that's what you don't know, and you look that way, and you'll see nothing at all because you're ignorant of what you're ignorant of. So it's just the way we are and the nature of our species that we tend to believe that we know almost everything. And most of what we think we know falls under the category of belief. Because we don't really understand things nearly as well as we think, but we believe we do. And when you have a belief, you actually are in a trap. Because if you believe that it's this way, then any evidence that comes in that's counter to that, you dismiss it as spurious results, you know, goofy data, that sort of thing. So you tend to cling to the belief, interpret your world in terms of the belief, and dismiss things that are contrary to your belief. So the belief traps you. That's why I said earlier that belief is the enemy. We want to get rid of our beliefs and things. Instead, we want to have what I call open-minded skepticism, where you're open to everything, but you're very skeptical of everything at the same time. That's the only way you can make real progress. But most of us have beliefs that we don't even know are beliefs. You know, we believe these beliefs so completely because they're part of our culture. They're part, you know, they just seep into our mind from the groupthink, if you will, and we don't question them. And of course, that's the way it is. There's no, you know, there's no argument there. It's always been that way. Everybody knows that. You know, we have this sort of attitude, and science is just as guilty of that kind of thinking as any other group of people. They're no different than, you know, any other profession in that they tend to have their beliefs and they're they guard their beliefs just as jealously as any other group or any religion guards their beliefs.
I remember when I was a kid, my granddad gave me a job to do to paint the garage door, and there was two coats of paint to go on, and he'd be away all day playing golf as it was. and there was a tin of grey paint, and there was a tin of bright orange paint. And he left instructions, but I just thought, you know, I knew better. I thought, well, obviously the grey paint goes on first, because it looks really drab. And the bright orange paint is going to be on the garage door. It's going to look fantastic. Bright orange garage door. You're going to be able to see it from miles around. And so the grey paint went on first, and then I finished it off, you know, in the afternoon with the bright orange paint. And when he came back, he was like, oh, I see you've only half finished. And I said, no, both coats are on. And he says, what do you mean? I said, well, I put the grey paint on and then the orange paint. And he said, well, I left you instructions, which you obviously didn't read. The orange paint was an undercoat, which would protect against rust. And I actually want the grey paint as the top coat, because I don't know if you noticed, but the front door and all the wood details of the house are painted grey. And I was like, but I thought, and he just cut me off and said, don't think, no. And yeah. I never ever forgot it. And if you translate that into don't believe no, then I thought about it in subsequent years, and I thought, well, if I don't accept belief in anything and I want to know it, then to be quite honest with you, I don't know anything really. But to admit that for some people, I think is a bit too much, because like, what do you mean? We must know something for sure. Otherwise, where are we? And I think that's a big problem, whether it's, top flight scientist or just your average Joe Sixpack watching the TV. Everybody thinks they know. And to say that actually we don't really know what the hell's going on or what it's all about, for some people can seem like a position of weakness. You know, just to say that I have a particular perspective on how things are today, tomorrow morning, 1 hour from now, that might change. I think that's actually very liberating, but I think a lot of people find it very, very threatening and worrying.
Yes, they do. I think coming to that point that you mentioned is a very good point. And that is, if you really examine what do I really know, you will come up with a very short list. There's very little that we actually know. Most of it is what we believe, what we assume. And we assume what most everybody else assumes. You know, we're part of a culture, and we believe the things that are, you know, that our cultural beliefs, things our culture believes. And those things, we don't see those as things deserving skepticism. But if your mind is open, of course, you as the painter, an open mind would have looked at the two paints and said, well, I wonder which goes on first. And then would have been the skeptical part that was said, well, I'd think that drab gray probably goes on first, but I'm skeptical. Let me find out. Let me go see if Grandpa left any, you know, more specific directions than that. Or let me look around and see if there's any clues, like all the gray trim, you know, around the house. A little bit of skepticism then would have brought a different, viewpoint. But we don't do that. And the way you approach the garage paint is exactly the way everybody else approaches their life, their career, you know, their relationship. And almost everything that we do is done in out of this sense of we think we know, but mostly we're working on assumptions and beliefs. And we don't really take the time to find out, to dig into it and look deeper. Look for a bigger picture rather than just the little picture that's right in front of us. Let's look for some context here. And had you looked for context, you would have seen the gray trim. But we generally don't do that. We just assume that we've got it right and go on.
Or perhaps we'd have said that the gray trim was anomalous data.
Yeah. Well, look at all that gray trim. He's probably going to paint that orange too. I guess he just got the undercoat on and hadn't finished. Well, he'll be having me paint the rest of that trim later on, I guess. Yeah, I suppose. That would be another belief, though, wouldn't it?
It would be. I mean, you talked about the period in time or periods in time when scientists would, not all of them, of course, but there's a general consensus would have been that, you know, it's all the information's in. We know most of what there is to know. We're just fine-tuning the details now. If that's the case, then what's going on at CERN? You know, why aren't they just mucking about with test tubes and microscopes? If you look at what they're doing with the Hadron Collider, it's like, my God, this is the biggest, most complex machine ever built by man. But what do we need this for?
Yeah, well, what they're doing with it is they're picking out details. They are, you know, they needed to find out whether or not their prediction of a particular particle existing at a particular energy in a particular place on the chart, whether that was accurate or not. So, you know, we spend, you know, several billion dollars to find out, but that's basically a detail. It really isn't a big, major piece of scientific understanding. Physicists will look at it that way because from their perspective, it might seem that way. And there is no other way to get that information except with a big, you know, multi-billion dollar piece of equipment, because the kind of experiments that they want to do require huge amounts of energy and lots of precision and lots of very expensive things. So if you want to ever find out the answer, then you have to spend the money. But it's not a kind of a scientific discovery that's going to make a whole lot of difference to, you know, most anybody's life. It's digging out the minutia of a theory that is actually not even really a very good theory. You know, what they call the standard particle model has a lot of holes in it and a lot of issues with it. And it is the best we have from a particle viewpoint, but then the particle viewpoint isn't really the correct viewpoint. So if you look at it that way, it's probably not very cost effective. On the other hand, science isn't about cost. Science is about finding out. And if you can find somebody to pay the bills, then the scientists are going to do the experiments, because that's what scientists do. So it's kind of just the way the system works that we do these things.
Did you read or listen to or just otherwise discover the news yesterday, I think it was, about this new particle that they've discovered at CERN?
No, I haven't. I haven't been looking at news for the last couple of days. What sort of particle is that?
I'd have to look it up. You know, not being a physicist, I can't quite remember the name. But yeah, this was on the BBC. I mean, obviously it was elsewhere, but I noticed it on the BBC. Mm. So therefore, that means it's been widely reported.
Sure.
So they've discovered a new particle. That's all I remember was discover a new particle, and the one other quote was new type of matter, which I was a bit skeptical about. Now, the last time something like this, it might have been the Higgs boson or something, but I still can't figure out if it actually exists or not, because you read so many contrary reports. But the underlying point here is about things being theoretical. And I think people do, interested members of the public, lay people, will read news coming out of places, particularly like CERN, because it, you know, gets so much coverage. And I think that they probably do have a big PR department because they feel they need to justify themselves.
Sure.
But people will read news coming out of that and they will take it at face value. They've got a new particle, a new type of matter. They're closer to discovering X, Y, and Z. And people go, you know, lie awake at night just going, wow, you know, that's amazing what they've done. But like so many things, it's not done as such. It's a new bit of a model or something else that's been expanded. And as you mentioned earlier, there's nothing wrong with models. You need those. And there's nothing wrong with theories, because they can lead you closer to an actual discovery. Sure. But to take all that as like, we can now put it in the textbooks, it's not quite as simple as that.
No, you talk about you don't quite know whether that boson is there or not. You know, there was a lot of press about the God particle and so on, you know, the Higgs. And the scientists themselves won't know for years. You know, it was probably 2 or 3 years ago when somebody first said at CERN, I think we've seen a Higgs particle. And then there was several years worth of more research, and they said, yes, we even think more strongly now that we've seen a Higgs particle, but it will be many years yet before what they think they might have seen is a certainty, if it ever becomes a certainty, because they're looking at things that are so minute. They're looking at things that are statistical, and they're looking at the 1/10,000th of 1% kind of things. They're looking at particles that last for billionth of a second, you know, this sort of thing. So it is so esoteric. It's so far removed from what most people feel and sense as being, you know, reality, that it's very difficult for the scientists themselves to understand whether or not they've really seen a Higgs boson or not. It's like we think we've seen it. We have some evidence that we've seen it, but, you know, whether we actually have or not, whether it's a fluke in the equipment, whether it's this or that, because we're looking at these tiny little microscopic details in a mass of data. It's like looking for the, you know, well, it's much harder than looking for the, you know, for the needle in the haystack. It's looking for a micro needle in a very big haystack. And then somebody says, well, I think I may have found one, but it's so little and it's so short-lived that I'm not quite sure. So it's, you have to understand that physics at that level is full of uncertainty. And it takes a long time with a lot of study, a lot of experiment, and a lot of dollars before certainty starts to build over years. So now you probably find a fair majority of the scientists think, yeah, we probably did see that Higgs. And there's probably some that said, well, I'm not sure yet. And there's probably a few others that say, no way. So that's just the way science works. It tends to always work that way. But when you're working into these extreme areas with minute times and minute distances, minute particles, it's very hard to tell what you've seen or whether you've actually seen it or not. So it takes a long time and a lot of data before confidence builds. And usually you have to wait until your equipment gets better to where this tiny resonance that you're looking for is more obvious. But that's the way science works. So we take one step at a time. But you're right. You don't quite know whether it's real or not. Well, neither does the physics community really know for sure whether it's real or not. What they know is basically a probability. It looks now like it probably, you know, we've seen the Higgs, which means they're probably more than 50-50. They maybe are 60 or 70, maybe even 80% sure that they've seen the Higgs, but that's a little different than really saying that, you know, you've seen it. But there probably will be a Higgs. I would tend to guess that they will find that little particle resonance, but I would kind of argue that the next question after finding that particle resonance would be, so what?
Yeah, I think that's really important. What leads beyond that, and it's part of the difficulty, isn't it, with justifying these enormous expenses? That yes, it might be fascinating on one level, and by no means am I saying that everything that scientists do has to have a dollar value or some, you know, produce like, you know, Teflon or, you know, napalm or something, yeah. Whatever, you know, not at all. But it's just, you know, they're imbuing it with such importance. But then what is the meaning of it?
Well, to most physicists, the meaning is that they are trying to measure what their theory says should be there. In other words, they have a standard particle model that I can make an analogy with to, say, the periodic table for chemistry. In the periodic table for chemistry, we line all the elements up, you know, by their atomic numbers and, you know, where they are. And then we can look at across in rows and down in columns. And we see things that are, you know, of in families and like things. And then we can see a little hole and we can say, well, you know, something should be here and nobody's ever seen that thing. Well, it should have this kind of atomic weight and these kinds of properties and so on. And then we go looking for it. And sure enough, there it is. So we name it Einsteinium or Americanium or, you know, whatever. If you found it, you get to name it. So we have all of these very rare elements that, again, exist for, you know, for milliseconds and aren't really common. They may be, things that are very difficult to find and isolate and even to maintain. But we find them and we say, aha, that makes us feel good that we know what we're doing here with this model that we call the periodic table. It just fills in another point. We predicted that it was there and it is. That's the way it is with the Higgs boson. They have this table, very much like a periodic table, and they have it lined up in like a matrix, just like the periodic table, and they go across rows and they have families and they go down a column and here's a hole. And that hole, they say, well, there should be something there. And that's the Higgs boson. Well, let's find out if it's really there. So that's what this expense is. And that is what the physicists would say the whole point of this exercise was. The point of these billions of dollars is that they found, they think, they hope, they found that particle that they predict should be there. And that's pretty much it. So it tends to verify the rationality of their model, because they made a prediction and the prediction was there. Now, the fact that it was just a minute, you know, resonance of energy that creates this little particle, you know, that's not a point to them. Now, it may be a point to the taxpayer who paid the money, but science, like you say, is not done because of the products it'll produce. Science is done just to find out why, or if, or how. That's the nature of science.
I thought I was losing my mind for a while, just, you know, because I thought they said it was there, and I thought, oh, well, that's interesting, you know, and then it was like the theory, and it was there, and then it wasn't, and I suppose it's a bit like particles, isn't it? They're popping in out of existence, but, but it was kind of like, what the hell? You know, look, can I order one of these on the internet, you know? Something. And in fact, it leads me to a question that some, you know, a general audience might have in terms of what is real. As we look at smaller and smaller particles, just use that word for the, you know, rather than any other for the sake of it, at what level does it enter this realm where it's kind of, I'm not sure if it's there or not, if you see what I mean? You know, obviously you can pick up a grain of sand. There's, you know, be things smaller than a grain of sand. Can't think of one off the top of my head. You get down and down, down under the microscope. Yeah, that's still there. That's still there. With our very, very, very small pair of tweezers, we can pick that up and turn it over and look at the other side. At what level does it become, we can't do that anymore?
Well, there's a level beyond which our instrumentation, you know, that augment our senses, our eyeballs and things, that they just can't see anymore. You know, we see with, it used to be the electron microscope, and now they may have some things that are just a little better than that, but we have our limits. Our equipment can only see things that are so small and can only time things that are, you know, have such a short duration. And beyond that, we just don't know, and that is called uncertainty. You don't know where the particle is. So let's take a photon. You know, a photon is a particle of light, and a photon has always the speed c. It doesn't go at any other speed. It doesn't go slower. It never sits still. It's always going at the speed of light. It's a particle of light. So that's very fast. So they're really hard to see one. You know, it's not like you can hold that in your tweezers. You've got this little particle, always goes the speed of light. And, when it's going the speed of light, it has no mass. It has a rest mass. Of course, it never rests. So this is the photon. And where is a photon? You know, point to one, you know, put one under your microscope. You can't do that. So there's a lot of uncertainty as to where a photon might be in any particular moment or what it might be doing. And within that uncertainty is the, you know, because of that uncertainty is why we have to describe these particles in terms of probability. And it turns out they really aren't particles at all. They are just probable particles, if you will. They are potential particles. And it's not until we make a measurement where a photon hits something and leaves a little flash of light on a very sensitive surface that we say, aha, there's one, you see. And if we start predicting what they're going to do and how they're going to interact and so on, the only way we can compute that, the only way we can predict, is to work with them as probability distributions. So we look at photons and say, well, there's so much uncertainty with where this thing is that we'll work with it as a probability. And if we do that, we can predict what's going to happen. Not precisely, not like, well, this will now happen here. What we can do is predict what's the probability that something will happen here, you see? And it may or may not. It's only a probability. So we lose this objectivity. We can no longer say that this thing is here and in an hour it's going to be there. We can't say that. All we can say is there's a probability that it's here and a probability that it's going to be there. It may or may not. So we don't any longer have this objective causal chain that one thing must lead to the next. If you have A, then you will have B. You know, given A and B, then comes C. It's not like that. It's, you know, you have A to some probability, and that gives you B to some probability. And if you take both those probabilities together, you get some other probability that you might end up with C. But you don't really know for sure, you know, that you'll get any of those. So that's the difference between the old Newtonian mindset of, you know, the laws of physics, which everything was, you know, the whole universe was like this big clockwork. And that's where our concept of determinism comes from. If you knew every particle, every particle's velocity, you know, all its initial conditions, then you could predict everything else that happened in the universe from then on, because it's all just this big machine, and you know how all the parts work. If you just knew what all the state that all the parts were in, everything else would then be known. And of course, it's not like that at all, because we don't know where all the particles are. We can't know, because it turns out they're really not particles after all. They're just probability distributions. It's not like there's all these little particles that build up like Legos to make bigger particles and bigger particles, and eventually you end up with the macro world. That's theory, but that's not really the way the world works. The way the world works is that we have probability of things interacting, probability of things being particular places, and that probability is a top-down a probabilistic model of reality, as opposed to a bottoms-up building with particles like Legos to build the macro world. So it turns out we're just looking at things from the wrong direction. And that's because science under Newton had this sense of knowing everything. You know, back to that. You know, we know it all now. We have all the facts. We just don't have all the information, but we know how it all works. And the whole universe and everything in it was determined that way. And that made scientists feel so good, because they knew everything, that they just have not been able to let go of that, even though quantum mechanics and relativity both tell them that, you know, you really don't know everything, and you don't know how things work, and you don't have this objective causality. The material world isn't fundamental. The probabilistic world is fundamental, and so on. But giving up that Newtonian worldview of the big, you know, clockwork universe has been very difficult for science to do. They cling to it and reinterpret things in terms of it, and they just don't want to let that go, because if you let that go, you have to admit that you really don't know. Again, it's this thing about you know, when you realize what it is you don't know, you find out there's a whole lot more you don't know, you know, than you thought. So they don't want to give that up either. They like the state of knowing that they had under Newton. And now with quantum mechanics and relativity, well, we just keep reinterpreting into ways that make us feel like we still know everything, but we don't. And scientists keep running into this problem because they have experiments, and the experiments cannot be explained in any other way than with non-deterministic, probabilistic science. And they can't get away from that. And now they find that the only way to really describe all of these various experiments that make sense is that reality is just information based. And that information is not objective, it's probabilistic, basically. So that's kind of where science is leading scientists today. But scientists, like every other profession, they want to cling to the illusion of knowing more than they actually know, so they cling to their beliefs about Newtonian clockwork universe. And it's always an uphill struggle to change that kind of momentum, that kind of groupthink among scientists or among any other group. You know, it's like back in the 1400s, when a couple of people thought the earth was round and most everybody knew for sure that it was flat. It took a long time. Actually, it took about 200 years between when the Greeks had they had enough information that they could logically determine, they could deduce logically that the earth was round. But 200 years later, you know, before everybody else actually got it, it took that long to get over that belief, that inertia, even though the facts on the ground were clear. Well, we're like that now. Now, I don't think it'll take us 200 years, because things move faster these days, because our communications are so much better these days. But we're still trying to slog through a very similar problem here with scientists being stuck in that the universe is made up of little chunks of mass and it has a deterministic causality and so on, which is back in from the Newtonian perspective.
It's funny then when on Star Trek, whenever Scotty says you can't defy the laws of physics, and it's kind of like, well, that's your job, Scotty. You do that every day. It just depends what the laws of physics are on any given day, I suppose.
Yeah, well, there are no more laws of physics. Like I say, we gave that concept up. You know, the physicists did get to that point where they realized that calling things laws was obviously people thinking they knew more than they did, because you can't say this is it. It must be exactly this way when you realize that there is, you know, decades and decades yet of new information that's going to become available that isn't available now. And we just aren't that smart as we think we are that it must be this way. It's a law. We now say, well, we think it's this way. It's a theory. It's a model. And, you know, science got over the law thing probably about 100 years ago. So we haven't had any new laws in physics since Newton, because all of Newton's laws, of course, were found out to be wrong. They only held in a special, under special conditions. That if you get outside of those conditions, then they don't work anymore.
I wonder where the word law, I mean, obviously it's going to have different derivations, different languages over the millennia, but I'm wondering what the original intention behind law was, because when I think of the law, I think of the police. I think of what we're allowed to do and what we're not allowed to do. And of course, that's totally arbitrary. So I wonder if the original use was, you know, within society, you know, the law is that you do not kill or whatever, or whether it originally was, oh, we've observed something, you know, the sun comes up in the morning, it is the law, if you see what I mean. Because if it's the former, then some American chat show host was quipping sort of, oh, well, if it was George Bush at the time, if he decrees it's the law that he can barbecue children on the White House lawn, then that's the law. It is the law. But, you know, obviously the rest of us just go, oh my God, what are you talking about? So it would be interesting to know, you know, law and law, which came first.
Yeah, well, when scientists use it, they meant that these were uncontrovertible facts. They always would be facts that they would always hold. They would never be overthrown. It was just the way the world worked. It was law, you know. That was the sense they had, something that was immutable and would never change. And, of course, now our viewpoint is that if you stand up and say something that's immutable and will never change, it just shows that you don't have a very big picture, because everything is likely to change. And if it doesn't change, well, fine, but you can't say that from your position here. You know, there's always new information.
I mean, from the top to the bottom of our society, I don't wish to expand this too much necessarily, but whether it's scientists or I just mentioned politicians or individuals, our inability to say that we were wrong or to change our minds or to be open to new ideas if it's going to compromise our career or maybe lose us a grant or something, what a tidal wave of woe and misery comes from that when we just can't say, sorry, I got it wrong. This is how if we think it is now, or it's okay, don't worry about it. You know, I was wrong too, or whatever. It's not that we want to be wrong all the time, but when we want to be right all the time, I think that's much worse.
Yes, it is. I think our problem there is that we have, in our culture at least, I don't know about other cultures so much, but we have gotten to the point where image is more significant than truth. Image is more important to us than reality, than the facts. So it's important that we look like we know what we're doing, that we look like we're right and that we're not wrong. And if we can keep that image up, then we're okay. Now, if the facts are that we really don't know what we're doing, well, that's not too important as long as everybody thinks that we do. So we're worried more about what people think and how they see us, which is our image, than we are about the facts on the ground. And that's true almost universally, at least within Western culture. We are very image-based now rather than fact-based. We don't, you know, okay, there is this reality, but that's not really important. It's what people think. It's what what people think is true. That's what's more important. If you want to sell a product, it doesn't matter what that product's value is. It matters only what people think that product's value is. You see? So it's the image that's important. Now the product may be wonderful or it may be, you know, a piece of junk. That really is not so important as a fact. Those facts aren't that important as to whether or not you can market it. You can market something that's junk if you can get enough people to believe that it's wonderful, even though it's junk. And that means you just have to convince them. So we've kind of given up the idea that reality is fundamental in our life for the idea that image is fundamental in our life. And with that attitude, then you can see why nobody wants to admit they're wrong. Well, that's bad for your image. If you say you're wrong, then you messed up. You screwed up. You thought it was this way and it wasn't. You're unreliable. So nobody wants to admit that they're wrong. Nobody, and being politically correct a lot of times means not saying the truth, but saying things that fit the image that we want to see. You see, we don't call a spade, we call it something that is more socially acceptable. And that's what a lot of our political correctness is. It's all about image. So that's why we have that nobody wants to admit they're wrong. It's because we now, in at least Western culture, find facts and reality to be a minor player in our life and in our relationships and whether we make money or, you know, get promoted or how we do our job or anything else. It's the image. If the boss thinks we're doing a good job, that's enough. Whether we're really doing a good job or not isn't important as long as the boss thinks so. You see? So why spend your effort working on doing a good job when it's easier to spend your effort on looking like you're doing a good job? Now, occasionally the two have, you know, those two meet up. And you can't look like you're doing a good job, you know, if your job you're doing is really bad and it shows. But that means you just have to not let it show, or you sometimes actually have to do a good job. But the primary thing is image, not reality, not facts. And that's just the nature of our culture. That's part of why it's so hard for the scientists to say, we're wrong. We don't know everything. You know, reality is virtual, and it's not deterministic, it's probabilistic. Because if they said that, then all of the things they'd been saying for the 100 years previous suddenly are all wrong. And it's easier just to, you know, have the image that, oh, everything's fine here. There's no, you know, we have no problems. Yeah, we got it all under control. We know what we're doing. You know, that's the image. So if you're going to be, you know, I call the scientists the high priests of Western culture, because the high priests' job is to tell the people what to believe and what not to believe. And right now in Western culture, we look to the scientists. The scientists tell us what is right and what is not right, what truth is and what it isn't. Well, if you're the high priests, whether you're the religious priests or the science priests, you have to keep that job. You need good image. And whether or not your facts are right, well, nobody really knows, because those facts are so esoteric, you know, and so hard to understand that even you and your other co-priests, you know, just kind of barely have an idea what it is you're talking about. So nobody else does. So it would, now you've got a wonderful situation where the truth is so complex that nobody really knows. And you are the high priest, so it's the way you say it is. And your image is important. So I think, Greg, that's why this nobody wants to, you know, nobody wants to fess up to their own ignorance, because that ignorance isn't nearly as important as their image.
There was a popular comedy show back in the early to mid 90s here in the UK. It was all about Catholic priests. And then there's one show when one says to the other, they're trying to understand some, you know, theological points. And one says, that's a great thing about Catholicism. It's so vague that nobody really understands it. And he says, I can't think of one question about Catholicism that can't be answered with the expression, that would be an ecumenical matter. And this reminds me, thinking about that, when I read about people writing articles about so-called scientism these days, and you bring up this question of the priesthood, and people, I've done a lot of interviews with guests who touch upon this or even get into it very deeply, and people react very strongly against this. I know I've had a lot of feedback along the lines of, if you're trying to tell me that science is just another religion or has come to replace religion, you're crazy. And it's not really what's being said, but it's being what is being said, that certain scientists and certain institutions, directly or indirectly associated with it, are starting, you know, have been behaving in quasi-religious ways. You know, they're being dogmatic, especially when dealing with the public. You know, it's been, you know, questions from the public are batted off, kind of like, well, it's just the way it is. You know, we should know. In the same way that you might get, again, if you grill the priest too closely about, oh, but why, you know, why does God let children die? That sort of thing. It's always just trust us on this.
Yeah, well, it's not really diabolical. You know, it's not that the scientists are, you know, diabolical and wanting to preserve their whatever. It doesn't, it's not that way. It's just that that's the way people are. Again, it's not just scientists. People all over are like that. It's, they aren't doing anything different than everybody else in the culture is doing. You know, they are believers. They have their scientific beliefs, like in a materialistic world. It's called material reductionism. And that is that the world is basically made out of stuff, and that the stuff comes in smaller and smaller parts. And if you start at the bottom, you build everything else up out of the small parts. And that's material reductionism. And science believes that. And their own experiments tell them that is not true. It's not made of parts. It's made of probability distributions, you see. It's not really made of little hard chunks of mass. It's, doesn't work that way. It's a probabilistic model. You can't predict what these particles are going to do if you treat them as little chunks of mass. So physicists have gone beyond that. But even though they go beyond that and they understand that intellectually, at a deeper level, they're still hanging out with Newton. They still see material reductionism as the only possible answer. And then they just call their science that doesn't abide by material reductionism weird science. Say, well, that quantum mechanics is just weird science. That's all. You know, it doesn't abide by our beliefs. Not that our beliefs are wrong, it's just that quantum mechanics is weird science. Now, when you look at it that way, that seems kind of ridiculous, right? But that's the way scientists, that's what scientists have talked themselves into. They hang on to their beliefs, even though their experiments are contrary to those beliefs. And they just say, well, it's because we don't understand it yet. One day we'll understand it, and it'll match with our beliefs then. So right now it's just weird, and let's move on to another subject. So that's how they deal with that. And the fact is, it's not weird science. Quantum mechanics is very understandable once you see the bigger picture. Not weird at all. It's very predictable. But you can't get to that bigger picture unless you give up material reductionism.
Oh, yeah. Of course, not to say that that it's diabolical. You're correct, of course, to point that out. I guess simply that in society, particularly, you know, in secular Western societies, science and scientists have been held up as, you know, offering us the answers. You know, spirituality, religion's fallen by the wayside, that they didn't have the answers apparently. So it's become so important in terms of, because scientists and everyone else is actually, whether they will admit it or not, they, you know, consciously or otherwise, they're seeking meaning. And they look for it in some, quite often in the wrong sort of places, you know, in sort of consumerism or other forms of hedonism, whatever it happens to be, in, you know, career, you name it. There's all sorts of places that we look for some kind of meaning. And as I say, science has just been held up as so important that, you know, we're, so many people are looking to it. And therefore we imbue the information that comes out of the scientific establishment with great importance. I mean, you only have to look at the burgeoning pop science shelves now in the bookstores. So, of course, it has a really important impact, you know, what is said and how the effect that that can have on the, you know, that flows throughout society and our attitudes. And because what we believe about reality affects how we live and how we react to everything around us in the same way as, you know, in in the Middle Ages that people did when they thought, you know, the earth was flat and there was a vengeful God, etc., etc.
Yes. And the thing is that, of course, science is a good thing. You know, it's not where science is a bad thing. Science is a very good thing. It's done wonderful stuff. It's given us lots of nice toys to play with. It's given us an internet that we can, you know, communicate, and we can do this, talk because of science. But what you have to understand isn't that science is bad or that it's gone, you know, it's gone evil or that they're trying to trick the people. It's just that science, as it is now defined as a materialistic, reductionist paradigm that is objective, that is an approximation. That holds true for all parts of our reality where the uncertainty is small. You see, it's not that science is wrong so much, is that science is just only works within a limited space. Newtonian physics turned out to be the same way. Those laws that were immutable and would never change, it's not so much that Newton was wrong, it's just that Newton's world only works. His theories only really work well in a certain range of experiences. If you go too fast, then Newton's laws don't work anymore. If you go too small, his world doesn't work anymore. So within the range of a certain set of experiences, Newton's laws still work just as well as they ever did. It's not that Newton's stuff doesn't apply. It only applies to a subset of reality. Now we look at the physics we have, our modern physics, you know, our quantum mechanics and our relativity and all the modern physics. Our science, as it's limited itself to a materialist reductionist viewpoint, is okay within a certain, you know, within a certain area, within a certain subset, where the natural uncertainty is small, things do approximate being objective. You do have deterministic causal chains, but they're all just approximate. Just like Newton's calculations are all approximate in the larger reality and good in their small reality that suits Newton, so is our physics and our science. It's good within the subset of reality and where it works. So it's not there's anything wrong with it. It's just that we have to see it as limited. It doesn't say everything. It doesn't talk about reality in general. It doesn't talk about the way the world works in a big sense. It only talks about the way the world works under certain conditions. And those conditions have to do with where there is very little natural uncertainty. When you talk about photons and electrons and hydrogen atoms and things that are very small and move quickly, then there's lots of uncertainty. And where there's uncertainty, these causal chains break down. You can only deal with those problems in terms of probability. And it turns out it's not that, well, they really are particles. We only calculate with probability. No, they really aren't particles. They're probability distributions. They don't even show up in this reality until the measurement's made, until somebody makes a measurement, and then the probabilities waves, they're not really waves, it's just a metaphor we call them, the probability waves collapse and form a measurable physical thing in this reality. So that's that's the way it is. Science is just wonderful, and we'll keep it. We keep Newton's physics. Not that people stopped doing Newton's physics because of relativity and quantum mechanics. My whole career was based doing Newton's physics because that's what most of the world still runs on, because most of the world isn't so fast that you have to compute relativistic terms, and most of the world isn't so small that you have to worry, you know, about quantum effects. So Newton still rules the world of applied physics, as it should. And the science we have today will still rule the realm of the small uncertainty, as it should. But you have to realize that reality is bigger than that. It's much bigger than that. And if you have a bigger view, you can put science in its place, the subsets of science, the Newton science and the quantum mechanics and the relativity and modern science, they all have a place. They just aren't the big picture yet. Once you understand the big picture, then you not only understand science and physics, but you understand consciousness. You understand the subjective as well as the objective. And all the rest of the metaphysics starts to fall in as logical consequences of the same theory that delivers science. So that's kind of the wrap up of the perspective, the bigger perspective on this science thing. It's not that science is wrong. They believe that their subset is the whole. They think they understand everything. And basically, like the Newtonians, what they understand only works in a subset of reality.
Well, Tom, as we begin to wrap it up for today, it just occurred to me, in terms of everything you've been saying, we were talking about the work at CERN and the Hadron Collider, and you know what an enormous undertaking that is, not just in terms of cost, but just what an amazing, you know, physical achievement that it is. You only have to look at pictures of the thing to go, wow, you know, look what we've done. We talked about what the data they're bringing in, the results, and what's being learned, albeit theoretical. At what point, I mean, given the enormity of that project, it occurs to me if it seems that there's so much left and that we're scratching the surface, you know, despite some people thinking, you know, we're ever closer to, you know, having all the data in, at what point were we going to hit the buffers, the limits with something like CERN? I mean, can we do one twice that size? Can we do one 10 times the size, 100 times more complex? I just think in terms of our 3D, five sense kind of physical reality, I could see us reaching a point where we just can't go any farther because we can't build this damn thing.
Yes, there are limits, of course. Everything doesn't scale. You know, all things can't just scale up and still work the same. So there are some issues like that. But given unlimited resources, if there was, you know, no end to the money tree, then yes, bigger things could be built. But there's a theoretical end to this, though. It doesn't just go on forever. But because, as it turns out, when we talk next time, we'll talk a little bit about the nature of this reality that we're in. And it turns out that physicists today are more and more agreeing that our reality is virtual. It means it's computed. It's information-based. And in a computed reality, you can think of it like your reality on your TV screen. It comes in terms of pixels. You can only get down into detail that's the size of a pixel or greater. You can't look at half a pixel or a tenth of a pixel. Things don't get any smaller on your screen than a pixel. So you can take a picture, and it's the same with a photograph, and not just a TV screen, but you look at a photograph, and you can blow it up and blow it up and blow it up, and eventually you see just pixels, a bunch of little dots. And if you blow it up any more than that, you may find space between the dots, but you don't find any more picture. In other words, there is no more information. The information is just in the pixels. So blow it up as much as you want, and then you'll have a bunch of dots with a lot of black space between them, but there is no more information. So your reality kind of ends there. The picture ends there. You have limits to how far you can dig down into that picture before you hit the pixel limitation. Well, a virtual reality, a computed reality, is like that. So even if you could keep building bigger and bigger machines, which there are limits, it doesn't just scale. There are other problems with bigger size besides budget. And even if you could build those, eventually, if you got down to the pixel, which is in most physicists agree that the pixel in our reality is called the Planck length and the Planck time. That would be the smallest little delta length and the smallest little delta t. And after that, our reality starts to pixelate. It starts to become granular. And at that point, you're not going to break anything else into pieces. You see, then you will have reached the fundamental limits of your ability to tear things apart and see what's inside. So you won't bust apart particles and see what's inside them, because you'll get to the point where there is no more information. You're ended there. So there is a theoretical limit on how far you can go with this, even if you could make bigger and bigger machines. But we're a long way from that fundamental limit. The Planck length and Planck time are very, very small, much, much, many orders of magnitude smaller than the smallest thing that we can deal with now. So we have a ways to go yet. And until we reach that that level of where we're looking at a single pixel, every time we take something apart, we will find something else inside, because that's just the nature of the way the reality works. So we find an electron and we say, oh, an electron, that's a fundamental particle. Fundamental meaning it doesn't have any parts. It's fundamental. And then, of course, we say, oh, well, now it has quarks. It's made up of, you know, three quarks. So we break it into pieces, and then we find evidence of a quark. And then we break quarks into pieces, you see. And we can keep doing that, keep calling our smallest particle fundamental, and then finding out later that they're not, until we get down to one of two things. One, the virtual reality just hasn't computed our reality at any higher resolution, or two, we hit the pixel limit. So that's, you know, a virtual reality is information, and information has to be computed to some significance, some level of smallness. If you have a simulation, your simulation can be in more or less detail, more or less refined. It depends on the, you know, in a digital simulation, everything is done in little discrete steps. That's why they call it digital. And the size of that step is basically the size of your pixel. You can't, there is no information any smaller than the smallest size of your step. So we may find that our reality is computed down to a certain level of precision and no further, in which case that will be where it ends. And that's probably going to be where our pixel limit hits at exactly the same time. I doubt that those two will be very different. And we've got a long way yet to go. So if we think we've found the last particle, that Higgs was the last spot in the chart and so on, well, we just haven't built a big enough machine. We will take those things apart and every other thing we can take apart. And when you pull something apart, well, if you're in a virtual reality, then the reality has to show you what's inside. And what's inside has to be consistent with everything it's shown you up to that point. That's the nature of reality. So yes, we can keep building bigger machines at higher energies, but the one that we have, like CERN, it's not that we can just keep raising the juice, you know, just pushing the pedal toward the metal more on that. You have to get a bigger machine. It takes up more space. It's going to have to start over, and you're going to have to either enlarge CERN, build onto it, or you have to start over and build a whole new design to work at a larger scale. Well, you know, at several billion dollars a cut, you're not going to do this. So I think you run into the budgetary limit long before you run into the pixel limit.
So a case of guys, get down to Staples, we're going to need a bigger chart. Okay, Tom, as you mentioned, we're going to pick this up again in the near future. In the meantime, tell listeners just about where they can find information about you online. You mentioned you've got these lots of videos on YouTube, website. Books are widely available. So just tell folks about that and anything else you'd like to share.
Okay, there's the three books, a trilogy called My Big Toe, which is my big picture theory of everything. And those you can find at all the usual places. These days, most of the usual places are Amazon, but you can find them there in Barnes & Noble and in your neighborhood bookstore. And if your bookstore doesn't have them, they can order them. I have a international distributor that sends books anywhere in the world. You can get them from my website, which is www.mybigtoe, all one word, of course, mybigtoe.com. And if you go there, you can order books, and you can also get to the YouTube site from there, or you can just go to YouTube. And I guess the easiest way would go to YouTube and put in a search on TWCJR. 44. That's TWCJR44. If you do that, it'll take you right to my channel. But if that's too hard to remember, just go to Google and put in My Big Toe or put in Thomas Campbell, and I'll come up on the first page, and then you can find all these things. The YouTube videos, there's about 120 of those. All the interviews, all the workshops, all the lectures that I have done, I put, if I get video from them, and often even if I don't, if I just get audio from them, I put them up on YouTube. My books are available for free on Google Books. So if you don't mind reading books from a computer monitor, you can get those for free. My theory is you share. as much as you can, and people will respect that you need to make a living. And when they want to buy, when they want hard copy, or when they want other things, they'll come pay for it. So anyway, those are the sites. There's another site if you want to know where I'm going to be, where I'm going to be giving talks. Then go to www.mbtevents, and they kind of keep track of all of my schedules.
Excellent. Well, Tom, thank you so much for joining us today on LegalizeFreedom.com.
Well, I'm glad to be here. It's been fun. I hope your listeners find it interesting, and I think we got a lot more to talk about, so let's do it again soon, Greg.
Well, folks, that's it for another week. As ever, thank you so much for listening. If you enjoy the show, please check out the website, that's LegalizeFreedom.com, Legalize-Freedom.com, where you'll find an archive of programs offering alternative views on a wide range of topics, including world affairs, politics and economics, science and technology, religion and spirituality, conspiracy, and alternative history. You can also browse and buy a range of books and DVDs from our guests, and if you're feeling generous, make a donation to help keep the site up and running. Until next time, I'm Greg Moffat, and you've been listening to LegalizeFreedom.com.